Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Couch Revisited. We've been on hiatus for a while now, so it's great to be doing the show again. My guests today are billed as a bluegrass and old time music band with a Jewish perspective. I'm thrilled to be speaking with Donnie Zasloff and Eric Lindberg of Nefesh Mountain. Thanks for taking the time, guys.
Oh,
thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us, man.
Yeah, so I want to start with how you guys came on my radar, because it's just such a wild and cool story to me anyway, if you'll indulge me. So the first
I
day
will.
Of Merle,
yeah, I loved it. Yeah.
Yeah. So the first day of Merlefest fell on Yom Kippur this year. And you know, I'd attended a virtual morning service that Thursday morning. And, you know, by the time I got to the festival, I was kind of, you know, you kind of feel a little like newborn in a way. So it's like the old cliche, like, you know, this is the first day of the rest of my life. You know, gonna go out and grab the new year. But I'm also in this place where I have all these images of my past and things like that. And I'm supposed to be covering this festival like as a journalist, but I'm nothing but like pure emotion. And I don't know what I'm gonna do. I don't know how I'm gonna write this. But then it was on Friday afternoon. I got a press release, and it was about you guys, and kind of told your story. It wasn't even about Merlefest. It was just randomly came in, and I was like, this is, it just kind of clicked. I was like, I kind of know the lens that I'm looking at this through. This kind of seals the story for me, even though I don't know how it's going to go or how it's going to end. So that was great. Of course, then there's this pressure, because I'm like, wait, I'm seeing these signs, if you will, here, that I'm like, but what if this is Friday, they play Sunday. What if I see their set and I'm like, yeah, I don't really like this. Now I have no story. But it turned out that it was fantastic. It was super inspirational. The audience was positive. It was just so wild for me in that moment to see these various things come together. That included you guys. And so, yeah, that was, I just wanted to kind of share that with you. I know you had read the article, but so that was kind of my experience. What was your Merlefest experience?
Well, thanks for sharing that. That's awesome. And of course, I'm glad you liked the set and the music that we're playing. And thanks again just for having us here. Merlefest was fantastic. I mean, also surreal, because we're all in this kind of weird world where we've been mostly alone and kind of, you know, in our own little bubbles and where we live, and we're coming to you here from the Northeast, right outside of New York City. Yeah. So we've been, you know, at home for like all of everyone else for the last year and a half. And then as my wife, Donnie, who you'll hear from as well, keeps putting it, it's like we got slingshot from this cannon down to North Carolina, one of our favorite states, and a great place to play always for us. And then to be on stage at, you know, one of the most iconic bluegrass festivals ever that I've been knowing and loving since I was a kid. So it's very surreal, but overall just a wonderful experience to be there down there.
I think surreal also because I don't know if you just now mentioned this, but this was our first weekend back,
right,
after not touring for over a year and a half, and we just had a baby. So
oh,
like,
I didn't mention that.
That's why it was surreal.
Well, surreal in general. What?
No, but we haven't played in a year and a half.
I haven't played in a year and a half. Yeah. We just had a baby who's now 3 months old.
Yeah, so there's a lot.
And I think just socially, it's like we're still like, oh my God, there's people in the world. We're going to go down and play for them and talk to them. And it's all new.
Yeah, so,
but Merlefest was great.
Yeah, it's kind of great. It sounds like we were all having these, you know, wild emotional roller coasters going on at Merlefest. One thing that's weird for me is being local here. I've kind of always taken Merlefest for granted. You know, to me, it's a little bluegrass thing over here at the community college. I don't think I ever recognized it as like the big deal that it is. To me, it's, you know, it's a local thing here in Little Bills County. But, it, you know, the way you just described it, it's as one of the new political terms go, it's a big freaking deal. And that excites me a little bit too, just to know that, you know, here in this little hometown is this thing that gets, you know, nationwide and probably worldwide attention at this point.
For sure. It is this, it's worldwide. I mean, it's got the history of Doc, and he's obviously one of the fathers of like, for me, just modern music in general, and Doc and Merle and the spirit of the music from North Carolina and bluegrass old time. And for us being from the North, you know, I'm from Brooklyn, and people ask all the time, you know, how did you come to love bluegrass? And I can't always explain even how exactly this music came into my heart, into my life, being from New York, being from the city. But, you know, it is one of the festivals that you hear about up North that you kind of fantasize about. You're like, oh, to play down there, really where this music comes from. And it's a big deal. It's a big deal.
Yeah. And just, you know, just another thing. And again, yeah, I've kind of described to you where I was coming from there. This was my first time there, by the way. And I've lived here since the festival started.
Wow.
And I used this phrase before, but you take things for granted. And when I got there, it was just so beautiful, you know, the trees and the mountains, and it was awe-inspiring in a lot of ways. I wasn't going to ask this because I kind of didn't want to project like my own concerns that may be unfounded. But I saw that Donnie had addressed it in the feature you guys did for Rolling Stone. And that was about going to some places and you're singing the Hebrew and bringing this Jewish culture in, and maybe having some, you know, some concerns on the reception based on that. And, you know, I've lived here all my life. I've never really experienced, you know, any overt or witnessed any overt bigotry, but it's a very conservative county. And this obviously isn't exclusive to any political party. Hate and bigotry never are. But some of those groups have seemed to find a home in the conservative party here. And I was just kind of wondering, is this a concern you guys have generally? Is it something that I'm just kind of wildly overthinking? Have you had any bad experiences, or is it just something that you think about?
Yeah, it is something that we think about. It's not something, luckily for us, takes over our lives. It's not like we're paralyzed by fear where we can't go out and do our thing and play music, you know. But it's hard. You know, we just released an album called Songs for the Sparrows, a lot of which came from a trip that we took to Eastern Europe where we wrestled with a lot of our past, historical past as Americans, where our ancestors came from Europe, where a lot of them, you know, unfortunately died in the Holocaust. And that's like a hard truth for Jews. And everyone kind of lives with that still. And actually, I think that across the board, we haven't really come to terms with those feelings of pain and those feelings of hurt and fear. And we're always kind of fearful that something like this, I mean, that happens, that, you know, 6 million of us more were wiped out. And like the fact that it's not just some story, it is a hard truth of the world. And there is always this, like, there's still people out there that feel this way, that, you know, that Jews aren't, that shouldn't be here, shouldn't be around. So it is, and it's heavy and it's deep. And luckily, like I said before, we don't walk around this in the, you know, thinking about this all the time, but it's there. And it is a little bit harder. You do question, should I go to this place if I'm heading down south? But luckily for us, across the board, we have been caught by our audiences, you know, and embraced and loved and given standing ovations, and, you know, and the folks that we've been able to collaborate with in the bluegrass world, from, you know, our over the years, our friends Sam Bush and Jerry Douglas and Brian Sutton and all these guys that I've loved and admired my whole life, we've largely just been embraced. But what you're saying is true, and I think that ultimately for us, we try to make music that's just, at the end of the day, just honest to who we are. We're husband and wife. We have this crazy circus traveling family with the baby, and we're Jewish Americans. And somewhere along the line, like, we're going to sing something that might be spiritual, that might be based on our history, that might be just about bluegrass. We're just trying to write and embrace all of this stuff that kind of makes us who we are. And I think as a kid growing up who's loved bluegrass, who's also from New York City, I also have family down in Georgia, I think I've wrestled with all of these elements of like all these different sides of life that, you know, from the city to the suburbs, to the country, to the mountains, to the, you know, bustling streets, all these different landscapes, these different religions and backgrounds, somewhere all of it's kind of circling through us, and for me at least. And it's all there in the music. And I think we try to represent it that way.
Yeah. And I think too, kind of circling back to that just a little bit, talking about your trip to Europe, to me, I can see how, and this is kind of a, I would say a traditional bluegrass thing. The phrase that I would kind of think of after that experience would be, you would come back with music that was kind of drenched in agony. But you guys don't tend to really present that in the music. It's more about, you know, hope and joy and love, instead of, you know, that album could have gone a very different way based on those experiences, what I'm saying. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally makes sense. Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a great point. No one said that yet, actually, about this record. I think that, in some ways our hearts went to there, but I think, and that's the beauty of bluegrass music, is that, you know, you've got these old songs and murder ballads and songs about longing and agony, like you're saying, but through the music, it's actually this joyous representation about actual life and rebirth and renewal and all this stuff. And that's kind of part of the history of bluegrass. And as Jews, you know, it's part of our own history as like these wandering nomads that have been part of this great diaspora since, you know, for thousands of years. Part of the kind of Jewish ethos is to live in the moment and live in the now and try to embrace endurance and how we're going to get through these and how to do it together and how to embrace these things that, you know, don't dwell in the agony. I think there's a really cool parallel there between what I think you were saying about the bluegrass world and how the Jewish thought would look at these dark times, is how to like put a spin on it, and actually maybe there's light to learn from it than it is to dwell in the dark.
Yeah, thinking too about Songs from the Sparrows and just kind of my reflection at Merlefest, you know, I'm a Jew by choice. I converted with Mark Cohn from Winston-Salem, who I think you guys know.
We love that rabbi.
Yeah, he's really cool. But I was kind of thinking about, as it kind of came across in the article at the end, but I was thinking about the tour you guys did and how you're relating it to things that happen in the here and now. A thought came to me. This was back the factory I talk about in the article that I worked at across the street from the community college. That factory closed in 2001 under NAFTA. All operations moved to Mexico, to Reynosa, Mexico. And this happened to be at the same time when there was an influx of immigrants from Central America and Mexico coming in. And, you know, when it closed, I didn't have any type of hatred or anger, but I didn't fall completely into this, but I at first had this kind of, you know, this cliched thing that you hear all the time, though, they took our jobs, this kind of thing that people had.
Yeah.
You know, I was kind of thinking about, you know, in another life, you know, I could have easily gone down a path of, you know, being, you know, like a MAGA person who's, you know, closed the borders, things like that. And I think too, I started thinking about the two things that kind of saved me from that. And one, of course, was, you know, going to college and meeting a diverse group of people. But the other was a story I thought I would share with you. When the announcement was made that the factory was closing, I was over the training department. And there was a group of people from Sri Lanka that were over, and they just wanted to, they had the similar machines that we did. They wanted to see how we did our training. Once that announcement was made while they were there, apparently there were some threats, and I was basically told, take them sightseeing. They had another week and a half, 2 weeks left, but they, you know, just take that. They can't come back to the factory. It's not safe. And, you know, these were guys that were, you know, my friends now, and you feel very protective, you know, of your friends and family. And I was kind of like, you know, to me, I think what really opened my eyes at that point was, okay, the factory is moving to Mexico. These folks are here from Sri Lanka. One thing has nothing to do with the other. But it was just convenient. These guys are foreign. These guys are brown. These guys are different. So this is where we have to direct things. And I think it was really that point that kind of made me see the senselessness of this kind of hate and bigotry and things like that. You know, it doesn't really matter if A plus B equals C. Sri Lanka, Mexico, they're different. They're brown. We're going to take out our anger on them. And I think that experience really kind of saved me and took me down a different path.
Mm. Wow. Yeah. I mean, thanks for sharing that story with us. It's what a horrible thing to witness, but you know, you were able to see like something, I guess, through that. It's, you know,
yeah, and I think
it makes me.
Yeah. I think my question was kind of tying it back to also your time in Europe of, you know, when you think about the Holocaust and things and you think about, you know, evil and people being evil. And then you also can kind of look and see how these things happen so fast and how it's not that hard for people to get together and, you know, focus on this mysterious enemy. So I love what you're doing with sharing the joy and the love. But it's also I just kind of wondered if that struck a chord with you as far as, you know, with the album of kind of how easy it is for people to get wrapped up in hate and anger instead of love and joy.
Yeah. Hi. I'll answer that one.
Yeah.
No, I think that we were overwhelmed with the reality of hate that's you know from our past and even that's going on now in this country as you were talking about. And you know, I think what we tried to do with it was, in a way, the album was a way of comforting ourselves. So I think you know, rather than, as you said, like, you know, going down into the rabbit hole of darkness and looking at the dark side of everything, it's like, okay, well, how do we live our lives? And so we wrote this album as a response to feel better, I think, number one. Yeah. And also I think because music is so magical and can really touch people in a very special way, you know, we thought that this album could be a way for people to soften or to have a new perspective or to kind of break down some walls or something. Like we had hope that the music is a way to touch people in a way. So, you know, we're not politicians. We're here to just spread love. And I think that we realize that music has that ability. And, you know, if one person is touched in a very, you know, can open their heart to this, you know, from our album, then that's pretty great, you know? So that was kind of our goal, was to just kind of use music as magical, you know, love.
Yeah. Yeah. It definitely struck me that way. I love to get kind of more specific to the music and for me to stop telling you all the story of my life. I do love the inclusion of the Hebrew in the lyrics. I can only pick out certain words. Are you guys both fluent? Do you guys both speak Hebrew?
I am not. Donnie is way closer to it than me. although, you know, there are certain words that there's prayers we've been saying our whole lives, just part of our culture and, you know, background of going to Shabbat and holidays and everything as a kid and, you know, lighting the candles with your family and all this stuff. So there's lots of Hebrew words that I know. I'm not fluent. When I go to Israel, I can kind of, you know, get by a little bit here and there. I actually lived there for a minute when she was younger. So she volunteered in the army over there, but she can speak it. She's actually really, and she's got a great accent when she really nails it. But, I think for us, when we sing in Hebrew, we are singing obviously words that we know and phrases that we know, prayers. On the new record, we actually wrote one in the song called The Sparrow Song. There's a section in the bridge of the song in Hebrew
which is based on a poem that we wrote in English. So that one is actually kind of our own original Hebrew sort of poem that we did cross-check with some friends out in Israel to make sure it was good. But it's part of our identity that is like, it kind of brings us closer to this ancient world, this like old way and old version of our ancestors that have been speaking these words and some of these prayers and everything. It just makes us feel kind of grounded in that. Many songs, of course, we don't use Hebrew, but there are songs that we do, and we always feel an extra connection there.
Yeah, for sure. And it works. It works so well with the bluegrass. It really kicks it up a notch in ways that I found really inspiring. I was like, you know, this, you know, again, if you think about the bracha and all that, you really can't picture it in the bluegrass style until you hear it. And then once you do, you're like, oh, wow, this works. You know, it's fantastic.
Oh, man. Thank you.
So I want to ask about your guys' approach to songwriting. Is it a thing where like one person is the lyric person, the other is the medley person, or are you guys like wholly collaborative? It could go either way.
I mean, Eric is the real everything behind the music. I mean, he plays all the instruments, and he studied, you know, music for years and years, and, you know, it's really him. I'm always part of the discussion and collaboration of, you know, the ideas, and I work on all the lyrics with him and some melody, but really Eric is like the one who goes downstairs and comes back up with like this incredible thing. I'm always amazed at him, but yeah, I really, Eric is the brains and but we do everything together, and everything kind of comes from both of us in a way. But it's you.
Well, yeah, in a way, but I think a lot of the key, the big melodies that we end up singing, like the hooks or the melodies that we actually sing for verses or whatever, I need your approval on them, or we do collaborate, or you have written them. So to me, that's just pure 50-50. I think a lot of the instrumental parts are up to me to kind of like compose and arrange for the musicians in the studio or for the band. But I feel like a lot of the songs are a split, especially the ones that we end up playing live and some of the bigger ones that we put, like Wanderlust. I think I might've had some melodic fragments, but I remember when we wrote that, we had a cabin up in Woodstock, New York, and we really collaborated on that chorus and that melody. I can't remember where they come from a lot of times. And it's different for each song.
We're super codependent. We spend all our time together, so we don't really.
Totally codependent.
I get that. I remember the story of the one song. I apologize. I can't remember the title. The Anne Frank song that came from a germ of a thing. I think it was that your daughter had said in the car.
Piece of the Sun.
Piece of the Sun. Yes, yes. I thought that was just a fantastic story. Of how that song came about, and a fantastic song from it too.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So, another thing. This may sound like an odd question, but I have to ask it. There was a guy on stage with you in your band that really, I don't know what it was. He really just struck out to me. I think Alan Grubner, is that his name? The fiddle player.
Yeah, quite. Yeah, he's the fiddle player.
Yeah, I don't know what it was, but I was like, that guy seems like a lot of fun. I really dig that guy. I have no idea what it was about him, but like, I was pretty much sitting staring at him for like 15 minutes. I was like, this guy's very interesting. So I said, this is going to be weird in an interview, but I have to ask, you know.
Well,
Is he as fascinating as I think he is?
He is a lot of fun.
What was the question? What's his question?
No, I was just saying, is he as fun and fascinating as I assumed that he was?
He is. Yeah, he's a great guy. Great fiddle, great violinist, fiddler, or whatever he wants to be called. He's great. And the whole band, you know, our touring band, Alan and Dave, you know, they're like family and brothers, you know, they're great too. Like we, over the years, we've finally cultivated this band of touring musicians that based in the New York area. It's changed a little bit in COVID, but really just grateful to have band members that not only do we see ideologically eye to eye, but also we musically in the same way. And we also come from different backgrounds of different jazz, classical. It's not all just bluegrass all the time in our band. And it's just really grateful to have those guys. And Alan is a ton of fun.
One thing, I skipped over this a minute ago. I was kind of just curious. I think that Eric, you have like a jazz background. I was thinking about growing up, and of course this was something that kind of struck me too when you guys were talking about a blended family. My parents split when I was, I think, about three. But one of the best takeaways from that is they both had differing musical tastes. So I got to experience a whole broad range of music from 70s, 80s country to, it was a lot of boomer music, honestly, because they were boomers. The bluegrass stuff was kind of my grandparents' stuff. But, you know, on the other side, I had R&B, I had rock and roll. What are just aside from, you know, the obvious jazz and bluegrass, what other kind of musical influences shape your musical DNA?
I think that Donnie and I have very similar and different influences, which is like, I think in the center of both of our universes, it's like folk music. It's Bob Dylan, Joni Mitchell, and Paul Simon, and you know, like the classic stuff. For, I mean, it's classic is relative, but like for us, that's the, like, those are the songwriters, like, to me, that I've always aspired to. And of course, these are everybody's favorite songwriters for the most part, you know, the Beatles even. But you know, from that being kind of our core, for me, I also grew up, I was like kind of an alternative rock kid when I was younger. So, you know, I grew up with Nirvana and Green Day, and, you know, there's all these elements of, you know, the musical world that have influenced, you know, whatever we write. You know, there's still melodies that I sing and I'm like, where's that from? And it's like, oh, it's from a Pearl Jam song, actually. No, but I'm just saying that, like,
yeah, you have so many
more. No, those are my real, this is part of, it's part of it.
Right.
Yeah, of course. We all have like this strange path. But I think for me, when I really down, I think what Donnie's referring to is when I buckle down into my really guitar playing, getting obviously into the blues and eventually jazz, which is what I studied in college, and composition and all, and then dabbled in classical music theory and training and all that. But I have seen less of a part of it over the years because I've played so many genres, is that when you really learn different things about music and when you start to really study and become a fan of all of it, you see less boundaries between them all. You don't make those distinctions like, oh, classical, and this is jazz, and this is modern jazz, and this is bebop. And of course, that's good for historians because we need to like define what they are. And I say all this, and I'm rambling a little bit, because I think it's actually helped me make this music that we make with Nefesh Mountain, where I don't really necessarily see a reason to give it like, this is only bluegrass, and it's only this influence, and it's Jewish bluegrass. I'm just trying to make good music, and if some of it has improvisation in it, then great. If some of it's through composed, I try to get away from the you know, calling it something, because then it kind of puts me in the box. And I think a lot of artists are like that too, especially these days, where you just want to let all the influences, you know, whatever comes out, as long as it's honest and filled with some good intent, then it's worth singing.
So can we expect, now that you've talked about alternative, 90s alternative rock, can we expect Nefesh Mountain to do like a cover like Sturgill Simpson did of Nirvana? Are we going to have like a Soundgarden cover?
I wouldn't expect it. But if you were hanging around a campfire with us, I would sing Black Hole Sun. I'll say that.
I got you. Yeah. So you guys, I guess now, you may be on break now, but I'm assuming you guys are just touring the new record. Is that kind of your immediate plans?
Yeah, we're touring the new record. We have a big Hanukkah tour coming up, which is really just kind of we're going to play some different songs during the months of November and December, and of course Hanukkah falls at a certain time. So we're really excited to honestly be back on the road. Merlefest was the first, was really like the third show back into it for us, and we're just excited to be back with the band and play and take this little one. I'm looking at our daughter here, who's Will, her name is Willow, and she's coming on the road with us. We have a tour nanny, and we're going out and playing all the songs from this new record. It's exciting.
Yeah, for sure. So where do you prefer people find you? I get the feeling, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I get the feeling you guys aren't huge social media folks. Would that be correct?
No, we're pretty good on social media. I mean, we could be better in the with our daughter. I think it's like we're like early mommy dad mode, but like, no, Facebook and Instagram, find us and follow us. Sure. Our music, if everyone most folks these days listen to Spotify or Apple Music or Pandora or something. So our music's on there. Our website, nefeshmountain.com, you can find our tour dates and buy the records from us there. And I say records because that's a habit, but they're just CDs. We'll print them on vinyl one day. But no, we're definitely find us and follow us, and you know, we'd love to get the music out there as much as possible, especially these days. It's hard to for any of us in any profession, but COVID is still somehow, you know, strong, and it's hard to fully get out there and do your thing. So we need all the help we can get.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I hope everybody checks you out. Again, finding you has been very inspirational for me for a whole host of reasons. And I really thank you guys so much for taking the time to talk with me. And I really wish you the best of luck. And I can't wait to see you again. You guys are fantastic.